Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our special guest is Jean Lee, Chief Experience Officer at MailChimp, and we're going to talk about orchestrating UX. This episode is brought to you by Zeppelin. Designers are most comfortable in their own design tool, and that's the way it should be. But design files can be complex to other team members, and explaining them takes up time that could be spent designing and building. That's why designers use Zeppelin to organize their screens, show user journeys, and present their files to the team. Sign up for free at zeppelin.io to get started. Hi, Jean.
Hello.
We are super excited. It's rather flattering to have you as a guest.
Oh my goodness. Thank you, Jane, so much for inviting me. Honored to be here.
Before we get started, could you tell us a bit more about your background story and how you landed this spectacular job orchestrating a team of, what, 150 designers or something like that at MailChimp?
Yeah, I think there's a bit around there. Maybe I could start from sort of my background, and that would make sense in terms of what I do at MailChimp. So as a kid, I always loved storytelling and illustration. And for some reason, I had a knack for illustration, so much so that at the time when I was younger, I remember BMX bicycles were a thing, probably dating myself. And I used to draw BMW bicycles, and people loved it so much, they started buying them. So I started to sell my drawings. And then the funny story there is that one day during high school, I was that kid in the back of the class drawing funny pictures of the teacher and sort of in those cartoony kind of scenarios. And I got caught one day. She said, "Can I see you after class?" And I was like, uh-oh. I'm going to get
in trouble. Did you see a picture?
Yeah. So I walked up going, "Here I go again. I'm going to, you know, be in trouble." And she had at the time showed me the picture and said, "Hey, listen, you're pretty good. How would you like to be the editorial cartoonist for the school newspaper?" And I was like, wow, interesting. You know, a good thing can come out of my sort of bad quote unquote acts as a kid. So that's when I realized, wow, I could use my creative powers to do good. And so fast forward, I had this knack for being an illustrator. And then growing up, when I eventually decided that I wanted to get into the creative field, you have your typical Asian family persona that I'm going to talk about. And my father was like, "What do you mean, designer, illustrator? You're going to be a starving artist." And at the time, there was only really three options. It was a doctor, an engineer, or a lawyer. And so long story short, I ended up getting into medical illustration as almost like a trade-off. And the word medical was in there. And so it's a funny field, but it's a very highly regarded specialized field. And you really have to go to medical school for this. And so I went down that path. And then eventually, after my medical illustration, I really had this passion for graphic design because I fell in love with logos and typography. And that was my next venture. So I had an illustration background, graphic design. And I remember even drawing animations for, at the time, Cartoon Networks. I don't know if you know about a cartoon series called Cow and Chicken. And it was classic animations where it was on paper through slides and so forth. So I had that experience of storytelling. And then sometime around the 90s, I really saw a movie called Toy Story and I was blown away. I was like, that is what I want to do, 3D animation. And so that summer, I decided to get a job before going off to school to get a master's in 3D animation. And a company, which later became Razorfish, ended up giving me an opportunity. And at the time, there was like, "Gene, can you join us to design websites?" At the time called World Wide Web. And again, sorry for dating myself. And so at a sort of a pivotal point in my life where I pursue a degree in 3D animation and go into that field or take this opportunity for designing the World Wide Web and seeing where that goes. And this is about the mid-90s. And so I decided to join the company and we did a lot of the early .com work for a lot of the brands. And funny enough, I think at the time we designed the original Chase.com. And I remember going up to New York and working in the Chase building. And it's funny because they had to custom order me a Mac because they're all PCs there. And when it arrived, it was the era where it was the tangerine IMAX and colorful IMAX. And people would walk by my cubicle and say, hey, is that a toy? Are you really working? And it was kind of lonely to be a designer in a big company at Chase. Anyways, so amazing experiences there. And after that, I really fell in love with branding. And I was like, gosh, branding is the thing I want to do. And that's what sort of brought me to New York at the time at a company called Landor Associates. So I learned a lot in New York. And from there, it was a lot of branding, work in digital campaigns for agencies, so forth and so on. So I say all these things because if you look at the trajectory of my experience and for nothing was planned, but for what I've learned and experienced, it really is touching on the full funnel of the customer experience, right? From top of the funnel of brand campaigns to graphic design, identity work, to UX product work around SaaS applications, and then going to different companies like Scholastic and PlayStation, I started to see gaps in the experience. And what I mean by gaps is that, oh, you have the product organization on one end, you've got the marketing organization on the other end, and you may even have customer support on the other end. They're not talking to each other in the view of the customer. And at the time, I was really passionate about the customer and how to connect those dots and break down silos and so forth. And come to find out, there's an industry term for that called CX, customer experience. And I didn't realize it. And so I really pursued CX and got my CCXP certification and understood sort of the maturity of how you get a brand and organization to value customer experience. And if I rewind the clock, people do ask me, Gene, how did you leave Sony PlayStation to work at MailChimp? You know, because you're working on so many great things at PlayStation, even next generation PS5, and it was an amazing experience. And the story I tell is that, you know, I had heard of MailChimp before, something to do with email marketing, right? And I ended up flying and meeting Ben Chestnut, the CEO founder, along with leadership, and in that building in Atlanta, the headquarters at Pond City Market. And all these things sort of adding up to the thing that I call culture, right? It was the leadership, their vision, how they thought about design, the environment of how the design was shaped and inspiring for everybody when you walk into that building. And all of these were proof points on how MailChimp as a brand valued design and they cared about the experience. And so culture is really what brought me to MailChimp. And, you know, I've been here about 4.5 years and it's been sort of an amazing journey of what we've accomplished during that time.
I'm curious, during that meeting with Ben, what was the elevator pitch / primer he gave of the organization internally that sold you on the vision?
Oh, gosh, that's a great, great question. You know, I don't remember the details of that conversation, but I do remember early on, we handshook on the fact that experience is going to be the differentiator on how MailChimp will evolve and grow into a much bigger brand. And that was the light bulb that went off saying, if the CEO is saying that experience matters, and that is going to be a differentiator for the company, and that's going to be a key to driving growth and increasing brand value and all that, that's all I needed to hear, you know, because when the CEO says that and values it, then it makes the job of leaders like me a lot easier because you're not having to fight frictions every day. You're not having to fight for the value of design because it's rooted and built in at the top of the leadership. And so that really sets the tone. And I think that, along with how Ben has grown MailChimp over the years, and you know, even before I got there, MailChimp had this incredible reputation for design and how they navigated their decisions. Voice and tone was really well known for what we've established at MailChimp before I got there. And so the challenge to me was, how do you take a brand and a company that already has an amazing reputation and design is the DNA of the company, and then take that and elevate it even further? And so I found that opportunity to be awesome. And so I think that opportunity, along with Ben's vision, along with the leadership there and just the environment and the values and the culture, those all added up to, this is a no-brainer, Gene. You got to take the job. Plus, Atlanta is where family was, so that didn't hurt either.
Well, congrats on landing it. And obviously, it was a fruitful collaboration over those 5 years.
For sure.
Congrats on the giant $12 billion acquisition that happened last year. That must have been a shock. No shock, but definitely shock experience.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you think about the many proof points over the years, and being acquired by Intuit, which is an amazing company, for $12 billion, that is probably the biggest proof point of how MailChimp as a brand has grown. And if you think about brand, that speaks to kind of what we've accomplished over the years. And so it's amazing kind of milestone in history. I think there's a lot of records that that number set in terms of being acquired by Intuit and being a private company and so forth. So yeah, that was a huge accomplishment for the team. And yeah, I'm super proud.
As the chief experience officer, what does your daily job include? Like in general, like what are you responsible for and what do you actually do?
Yeah, another great question. I will start by saying chief experience officer or even chief design officer and all these fancy titles, they're somewhat new for design, right? If you think about chief marketing officers, chief technology officers, chief financial officers, and sort of the other line of C-suite, they've been around for a while. And so when you're around for a while, there's a set pattern of established languages, established norms, tools, all those that are almost accepted and understood what that role's about. Being a chief experience officer is somewhat new in the industry, and you're starting to see trends of designers having more of a senior leadership role in companies, but it's still, to me, in the early stages of that. And so the reason why I say that is because there's no really playbook, and sometimes you have to define that path at every company. And so for my role, when I started, as I told you, I had that handshake with Ben about experience. That's been the through line across my journey at MailChimp. And so my day-to-day responsibility is really about how do you take all the various touch points a customer has and make it delightful. And what I mean by delightful is that make it contextual, make it relevant, make it useful. And I call this thing called bookends, where if you think about a certain point of where a user is experiencing MailChimp, what was the bookends? Where did they come from? And what was that path like when they clicked on an ad, they went to the website? What was that kind of connection point? And then after their current experience, where do we want them to go? Where are they going next? So the bookends around that touch point of an experience. And that to me is an example of like, how do you take that full funnel from the moment they hear about MailChimp to the campaign they see and they click on it, to the .com experience, to onboarding, to the app experience, even to the experience of contacting support and help, getting inspired, like all those various touch points add up to what I would say my team is responsible for in terms of curating those touch points. But again, like anything, this is not just a single discipline's job, right? That takes the whole company to do. So in my role, I kind of see it as almost like an orchestrator where I'm bringing harmony across all these touch points, but I'm not the individual playing that specific instrument. I know enough about the value of how engineers, product, support, marketing, all those various players can play music, but it's about how do you bring all those together to make that sort of harmonious experience. So my day-to-day is really about that. It's like a bunch of, meetings on alignments, looking at work, encouraging and inspiring the teams, and so forth and so on. So my day-to-day depends and changes based on the rhythm of the company and the context of what we're trying to do.
Many years ago, we had a guest here, Roger Dudler of Frontify, and it's now positioned as a brand management platform. And the gist of the conversation, my takeaway from it was that big brands, they struggle to even like have consistent fonts, you know. Mm-hmm. And now I imagine MailChimp is one of those few companies that don't just manage to have well consistent fonts, but really truly try to make it consistent. So what is that special effort that differentiates you from other giants who don't particularly care about, well, they do care, they just can't manage it, but you obviously manage somehow. Like, what's the special sauce?
Oh, yes. And there's probably not one answer because every company goes through different things. But I think part of the formula, if I would kind of step back and assess the question, is that one, I spoke about it earlier, it's got to come from the value from top down. So Ben, being the CEO, values design, values those details and understands how design can elevate the brand and add value to the customers. And so that's number one. And when you have CEO valuing it, then the rest of the leadership and all those people value it too. You look at other brands and they're also proof points. I can say, you know, if you think about Apple and Steve Jobs, right? He was at the helm of that company, but he valued typography and he valued the sort of the details around design and experience. And so that sets the tone and it makes my job a lot easier when you have that already built into the leadership. Number two is that you have to have the balance between quality and velocity. And what I mean by that is there's a rhythm of the company that wants to grow always, right? Constantly growing and shipping things quickly. But yet you also have to balance that with quality. And by quality, it differs, right? So to your point of consistency around fonts, I mean, we've spent a lot of time standardizing guidelines, motion graphics, interaction patterns, but also our design system as part of the way we create velocity and quality. We spent a lot of time, probably more so than any other brand that I've worked for, around our design system. And we named it Wink after Freddy's wink and sort of how he acts. But that's about to launch. And I gotta say that that design system and what we've created has just been one of the milestones of my career, because it's not just a pattern library that people focus on in terms of the product area. It's not just brand guidelines under marketing. It's the full end-to-end guidelines for the brand, going from typography to assets to patterns to voice and tone. So it's pretty cool. And I think there's a lot of variables, but I would say those are the major things that really hold that consistency of how, like, even down to the typography being consistent.
Is it publicly available at the moment?
We do have public versions of our standard site. You can Google it, Voice and Tone for MailChimp. They are out there. But what we're going to roll out is a new version of that called Wink. So not yet, but be on the lookout.
That's why I've asked because your Voice and Tone document has always been here on as an example for anything.
Yes.
Anything. When it comes to guidelines, you know, being copywriting or anything. But
right.
Can't wait to see your live one. It's a form of marketing in essence, right?
It is essentially. I mean, if you look at Google's versions or every other brand, it's both utility, functional, but it's also marketing, right? So marketing for like the capabilities and almost like our point of views of how we shape and think about design systems. And that to me is what's most exciting, is that how we thought about our brand. You know, we have a term here called sort of a listen hard, change fast. And I think one of the benefits of having that motto across the company is that we literally do look at what's in the industry, what's changing out there and how we're evolving, and we adapt to that. And so one of the things you'll see in Wink is that sort of through line of how we're iterating constantly. I think if I step back, gosh, 20 years ago, branding was all about consistency, you know, make the fonts consistent, make the colors consistent, 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 consistent. And I think the new way of thinking about brand is about context, not so much about consistency, but contextualizing the sort of the patterns across different touch points. So if you think about campaigns, what makes sense for how a brand shows up there, or a social touch point, or even when someone calls MailChimp and what that experience looks like, .com app. So to me, it's about continuity and context versus consistency. But that's how you'll see the Wink standards come out. And like I said, I'm super proud of the team, and they've blown me away in terms of what they've accomplished on Wink. So be on the lookout.
Given that MailChimp is a relatively large product, even when we talk about the product itself, not even the marketing ecosystem around it, is there any central like artifact / I don't know, giant chart of customer experience that at least has the biggest parts of it and where everything lives? What's the reference point?
Yeah, great question. We've tried a lot of different things. I can give you some examples. You know, if you think about a product, there's a certain feature that the teams are working on, or different squads cross-functionally. But then there's a point where you zoom out of that feature and you go, well, how does that feature connect to another feature? And then how do you navigate across the whole entire app? And when you get to the altitude, there's got to be something else beyond just a specific button pattern or interaction pattern. And this has been in the works for a while in terms of how do you solve for that? You know, how do you zoom out and look at the entirety of the app? And we've tried many things throughout the years. And one of the things that we have on the table is we're using Figma and we're capturing certain instances on Figma, but then we're trying to zoom out and capture, like I said, the bookends for all the touch points across that journey. So when you go from a feature experience to a journey experience, that's where you have to manage that. And it's hard. I got to admit, there's no one size solution here. But we use Figma, for example, to like look at all those screens and patterns. And we actually also started to add in notes of like what we're finding around the data points, usability points, customer insight points. And so it becomes almost like this old term that I'm going to use, a sitemap view of all the patterns and all the screens, but also notes. And we use those for conversations cross-functionally. So that's been pretty cool to look at it from that altitude, but then deep dive into the actual UI and the details as well. So I think it's just a combination of zooming out and zooming in. And it's not perfect, but we find that that is a easier conversation to have when you look at something like that. The other thing is we use a lot of click-through prototyping just to actually get closer to the experience. So when you look at flat UI and you look at many screens, it tells one story. But when you actually prototype it and see the interaction, that tells the other story too, right? So interactions can actually convey and guide a user that you can't just see on a flat UX UI. So it's a combination of a lot of things that helps us look at both altitudes. And that's what's working for us. But again, like all things, we'll evolve too. I remember when we first started the CX journey and journey mapping, we used Miro and we made this huge layered file around the actual UX, layered in with user insights, data points, and all that. We had printed these things and made it wall size and took over rooms. And at that time, it was a great way of almost getting cross-functional teams acclimated to like, why are we doing this? And how do you use this? And what is this? That educational phase, if you will. But then over time, you know, it wouldn't scale because teams had to be physically there to look at the printouts and all that. And so we quickly translated all that, digitized it into Figma files. And this is all before COVID. So it kind of worked out.
You mentioned before that one of your most successful practices was, I think, experience reviews or something like that, something you do with your team on a weekly basis. Tell us more about this tradition or practice or method. How you
Sure. And I'll say it's always a journey to get to these things, right? It's never like, oh, this is perfect and we got it done in a week or 2 weeks. When I first started there, the designers were, they're about 35 or 37-ish, 37-ish, I believe, designers. And like I said, it's 160. So then if you think about how we talk about design reviews or critiques, it had to evolve, right? So when we first started, it was a lot more about maybe brand design or a feature design. And it wasn't at the journey level just quite yet. And so as the team grew and we got to a point where the product itself grew with all these features, we started having these experience reviews. And those experience reviews was a means of evolving just design critiques to looking at the customer journey level. And that took a while too. I mean, this is in the works for a couple of years now. What was interesting about that is that when it first started, it was hard because, you know, it's one of those things we're asking people to recognize when you have a brand campaign or when you're doing something top of the funnel and a customer clicks on .com or they go to the app, what does that full journey look like? And we're not incentivized to do that kind of level of work. People weren't used to connecting the dots at that level. And so it took a while to get there. And so we really started that journey just within design, just to get the behavior there, just to get people to understand what that looks like, the conversations. And what was also interesting is when we first started, like I said, in Miro, we started looking at that top of the journey level work, but it didn't get into the specifics of the UI, UX detail. And so it was hard to navigate those conversations on what are we trying to critique? Are we trying to critique the CX of it? Or are we trying to create the UX experience of it? And so it took a while to get to the right rhythms. But it was cool because we got to the place where design reviews or experience reviews was done on a weekly basis. We would carve out, I don't know, a half a day to look at it every week. And then what's even cooler is that there was always a vision that you can't just have it for design. You've got to have it cross-functionally if you really want to make change happen. Because one of the challenges and the benefits is that we got used to what experience reviews look like within design. But one of the challenges is that when we made comments or we made suggestions, it was in within the discipline of design, but it wasn't with engineering impact or product prioritization or roadmaps, right? So it was just a design critique. And so recently, it evolved into making it more of a cross-functional effort. So now we've got engineers, product managers, designers, all looking at the experience with data and having these conversations on customer value, business value. And I think that's ultimately where the impact of the product is. And so it's really cool to see it evolve. And those are weekly now and some are even bi-weekly, but they're just super cool to have it with our partners.
When it comes to, that's my favorite like question / problem in life is how design layouts in Figma turn alive. And that like undoubtedly involves polishing or something. But so your design layouts and your design team, do they come pixel perfect from the engineering? Do you do lots of polishing? How does it work?
Yeah, I mean, that's always a good question around like what I call prioritization, right? So when you grow so quickly, you've got a lot of UX debt, you've got a lot of maybe technical debt and so forth. And so we've done a lot of work in terms of even prioritizing those. We have customer week, we have all these other sort of innovation weeks where we spend, gosh, I think last year we spent a week across the company. And it's almost like a hackathon, but focused on the customer, you know, and we would spend a week looking at all those different details, whether it be polish, usability issues, tech debt, and we would spend that week executing around all those things. So, you know, that's one example of what happens when you start building a product over time, you add up to these areas of like you said, the polish and sort of the tech debt. And so time to time, you've got to like pause for a second and go back and iterate and fix some of these things. I've also seen it where you iterate along the way, and that's more ideal, right? So you don't just ship it and forget about the quality, but you ship it with quality. And that's, I think that's the art and science of how you ship product. And this is where it matters around sort of the systems and the pattern libraries and how you go about managing the velocity and quality. So every company is different, but I would say we're still in the thick of it, right? We don't have a perfect answer, but you know, we're getting there.
The hard question is, how do you deal with all the legacy? And I've talked to many MailChimp users because there are many and everybody has their own bit to say because email software, and as a founder of such, I understand everybody has strong emotions about it. And as you've been rather rapidly changing things up over the years, how do you manage positive, negative feedback? And like, what do you do with all the legacy and customer relationships around it?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think that's where you have to look at the higher collective, right? So if I think about measurement, right, without getting too subjective, you start looking at data. And if you, one of the things we've established is the voice of the customer. We're using Qualtrics as a tool, but it's a really good aggregate of what our customers are telling us. And so when you think about those things, there are themes that arises. And when you think about those themes from the customer viewpoint, there are two things that we recently saw in that. One is wayfinding, and the other thing is navigation. And it kind of makes sense, right? Because over the years, when you build so many of the features so quickly, it's like the example and the metaphor that I was talking about where you originally had a one bedroom house. And over the years, you've built 3 bathrooms, 8 rooms, and just bolted it on. And in terms of wayfinding and navigation to that house, you got to go through the closet to get to the bathroom, to go through the basement and so forth. And so that's an example of what we're seeing in terms of the voice of the customer. And it makes sense, right? So I think when you speak to those data points and what we're hearing from the customer balanced with where we're trying to grow from business, all those things help prioritize roadmaps and how we go about fixing customer issues and so forth. I think if you don't have that, there's so many areas across the board that you have to look at that it's hard, and it could pause everybody because you don't know where to start. And so for me, it's start with the data, start where you're actually hearing from the customers and what are those areas of the experience that matters, you know, that really will move the needle. Because I can look at maybe an example of an inconsistent button. And if you look at the ramifications of having efforts to change that, it might not be the priority at the time versus, wow, we really have to fix navigation and how they think about navigating the site to help, help them. And that's a big one. So that's an example of how you prioritize those things. But, you know, every company is different and it's really about trade-offs.
One of my personal biggest processes of, you know, maturing happened over the last 5 years running my own company, that it's only about priorities, like only priorities. It's not like we can't, but we are busy doing other things. And as users, as consultants even, we don't often realize that, unfortunately. But well, now I feel much kinder towards any product out there.
Yeah, for sure. It's not always the easiest, right? Because I can say these things of like, yeah, voice of the customer business. But sometimes those conversations are very difficult because every company wants to grow. You know, that's the business. Just everybody wants to grow and add more customers and grow the brand and so forth. But then on the other side of it is what you're hearing from the actual customers and their pain points. So if you think about, I don't know, like a topic like privacy. Oh my gosh, privacy is so complicated, right? So users are saying, hey, we want privacy and so forth and so on. But then there's a brand and how do you prioritize how to address privacy and the experience around all the privacy for users? But yet there's a business that needs to move forward and they need to prioritize other certain things. And so those are the tricky conversations of what the trade-offs look like. So that's just one example, but you know, every day you have to go through these things.
And there would be a customer or all of the marketers in the world who want, you know, resend the email to those who didn't open. And that is like privacy on one hand and that on the other.
That's right.
What do you do?
That's right. And you know, that's where you have to have those trade-off conversations of how do you balance that where, you know, as a business, here are the levers that make us grow and the value that we bring customers. And here are the preferences of what customers are saying and what they desire. And, you know, we have all sorts of tools to help us have those conversations. Sometimes it's like a scorecard where you look at sort of the problems at hand and the data and the insights and you say, okay, you know, how much of a lift is that from a technical perspective? Are you ready for having design ready for those, addressing those challenges? And, you know, you just go through it and sort of that's one tool of many, but you have to have those conversations constantly.
One of the hard questions, looking at user base, what is the percentage of people entirely on self-serve versus guided and sales and, you know, the high touch tier? Like what's the ratio? And only you can know from the inside of the business because yeah, the idea is that you serve small companies, but there must be some sort of guided / high touch.
Gosh, that's a tricky question. I don't know if I know the exact percentage. I do know
just
there's
roughly.
I mean, we've got half of our customers are global, right? So people maybe not recognizing that. Sometimes they think it's all US based, but we've got roughly, I think, 13 million active customers. It's like crazy numbers, like 15,000 new customers added per day. And so if you think about that volume of our customers, it's crazy in terms of how many people use our products. If you think about where we are today versus the future, you know, today the self-serve model is where we're going in the future, right? The personalized aspect of onboarding or using their data to help recommend the next best action. We've got a tool called Creative Assistant where literally you can type in a URL and it'll scrape all your brand elements, your logos, your colors, your photography, and it'll automate different layouts for your social campaigns. It really is amazing. And that's an example of do it for me versus you do it yourself. And you can actually go to the site and plug in your URL. I've done this many times and it's really cool of how all that's automated. And the goal of that was, the insight of that was that when you have these small businesses, they don't have time to create all these different layouts, nor do they have resources like a designer on their staff. And so this is us saying, let us provide you almost like a designer in a box, if you will, if you use MailChimp. And so that whole feature is what creates that sense of automation. And talking about automation, we also launched Customer Journey Builder, which is, you know, when you have an email set up and it automates different sort of trigger points. And those are all these features that just make it easier for the user and saves them time and creates that sort of we'll do it for you aspect of it. When it comes to the actual percentages, I can't pull a number out in my top of my head to give you.
What's your philosophy towards user onboarding? And I'm asking because your tool, Userless, the email automation tool, all are sort of tools where the user has to front load work and lots of work. And it depends on the inspiration as much as it depends on your effort, but probably more on the inspiration. What's your philosophy? Because you know for sure that only, 20% will get started for real. And unfortunately, you can't do anything about it because it's work. Yeah. What's your take?
Yeah, onboarding is such a critical thing in any brand. I will say that. Every place I've been to, onboarding was always a key thing that we'd focus on. You know, for me, philosophically, maybe I'll talk about that and then land it to what we're doing at MailChimp. Philosophically, if you think about onboarding, it's super key because it's the way that you curate that experience that makes a user value the brand even more so, right? So let me step back. You might hear about a brand through an ad or campaign and you click on it, going back to the example of the journey path, and you go to .com. .com is the biggest brochure that one has digitally to help convince, like, here are all the things you can do with our company. It's almost like what I call, or what we call internally, the promise. Here's all the promises that we're giving you as a customer of what we can help you in. And then the moment they sign up and they onboard, it's the start of the payoff, right? So we have a term called a promise to payoff time. When we have the promise, how long does it take to pay off that promise? Onboarding is key. So if you onboard and that is so frictioned with so many things that I'm tired of doing or it's difficult to do, and then you start using our products and you're after a time, you're still not getting the value, then that promise gets diluted, right? Because the promise is not quite there yet. And so the key is, how do you shorten that promise to payoff experience? And so onboarding is one of the key ways to bridge that. And so at MailChimp, we recognize that over time, we are going from a point solution email, right? Email marketing was our, you know, core brand. And onboarding was done in such a way over the years that just made sense. If you're an email customer and you want to onboard us, great. Here's how you do it. When you go from a point solution like email marketing to a whole suite of a marketing platform, that onboarding is different. And that customer base could be different. Meaning, if you're coming to us just for email, maybe it's okay. But if you're coming to us for commerce, like you want to set up a website, all right, or a landing page, and all, that onboarding is quite different. And so we're recognizing that onboarding is key, and we are working hard to almost curate those onboarding experiences where it's a lot more contextual to what that user is trying to do. And so it goes from, hey, this onboarding for email has worked, let's just use that, to what is the intent of that customer trying to do when they onboard? So we can curate that experience to onboard them better. And like I said, we're using AI and all the other aspects to understanding more data, who they are, to better serve them that sort of personalized ways of onboarding. My philosophy also says, you know, those days of having a thicker catalog or a thicker brochure is just not, doesn't make sense, right? Because people don't want to spend hours reading things. They want to start using it. And so the strategy in my head is we need to reduce the brochure wear and get them quicker into the app and using it to pay off the promise a lot quicker. And so that's what we're trying to do. And from a stat perspective, generally speaking, people convert much higher in the app than they do on the .com. And to me, that tells me that, you know, enough with telling you what we can do, show them. And so the faster we can get them to use the app and experience it, the better we'll do in terms of growth.
There's been this trend with MailChimp, and it's not maybe pleasant to talk about it, but you've been really restrictive with support, as at least the trend is like that. And now that I hear that you have 15,000 users per day, I can understand why. But given that you're customer focused, how could you? Like, what's the idea?
Yeah. By the way, that's a great insight and question. And this is, we're addressing that, right? So if I talk about the voice of the customer, going back to that data point, there's a third one. And the third one is people want to contact support. They want to get support for their various aspects of getting help. And in terms of that, we are addressing that. So if you look at the site, we've got contacts, contact support, even information and links within the site. We used to have it where it was hard to navigate, hard to find, but now it's more prevalent across various pages on .com. We also have the chatbot that's automated, you know, like you see across standards on other .com sites for brands, where we want to be there to support you along that journey. So that's changing. From years ago, we had sort of when it was just email, right? We were like, well, people probably don't need so much support. So we had supported them through online pages of guidance and knowledge base and so forth. But now people want to hear from somebody. They want to ask questions. They don't want to go through more documents and instructions. So what you're seeing more and more so is elevating easier ways to contact support. And you see that currently on the site.
Mm-hmm. Over those years that you've been here, 4.5, what would you have done differently if you were to start again?
You know, this is a little bit of a maybe a one-on-one statement, but they always say when you start, you've got to go through discovery and listen really hard in terms of where the company's at and what's right in terms of how you go about, you know, things like change management, maturing design, elevating, building trust in your peers and relationships. I knew that going in, but when I came to MailChimp, it was like the kid at the candy store. There was so much opportunity. You know, I was like, let's do this, let's do that. You know, Qualtrics, voice of the customer. I remember pushing all these things. And at a certain point, I looking back, I realized that I was too early. You know, I should have been more thoughtful in terms of what we needed, building sort of a better, stronger relationships in terms of how we matured. Not to say it wasn't there, but it was just, like I said, I was very excited about introducing all these terms and things into the company where maybe we just weren't ready. Looking back, now we're there, but we just weren't ready in year one or, you know, month six. And so I think that's the biggest takeaway is just knowing when you join a company to really understand where they're at, you know, people-wise, culture-wise, team-wise, tool-wise, design capability-wise and all that, and be patient on how you get to the maturity and build the team.
I recall advice from JD Forrest runs a portfolio of apps and keeps buying them. So when they buy a new tool, what they do is they first implement, they listen to feedback, they review feedback and the backlog. They pick one feature that's been long wanted, they implement it, and then they lay down low. Your advice. But yeah, they also do this little bit of exciting thing in the beginning. So I guess it's hard to resist. You need to make your mark when you join, right?
right. Exactly.
Well, we've got to wrap up today's episode. And a bit of advice for our listeners. Top three tips for establishing a consistent, coherent, but also respectful user experience.
Great question. I would say the first thing is really understand the user, get to know the data points, because you can look at anything from a best practice perspective, and that's great. But then you have to look at back at the user data. What are users saying? And then that will give you kind of a prioritized way of looking at what you need to solve first. The second thing is have a good stance on design language, you know, e.g. pattern libraries, brand standards, brand guidelines, because that'll help you create that consistency along with that user problem that you're trying to solve for. And the third thing is create close relationship with your product managers, your engineers, your peers, to help everybody align to a customer priority, as well as understanding how to balance that with a company. So I'd say those are the three things that I would kind of pick out at the top of my head.
We could pick the third one and have an entire episode dedicated to just that.
We certainly can.
How to inspire and enlighten your colleagues so that you can work on something together, right?
Correct. Yes. We definitely need our partners.
Well, thanks so much, Gene, for sharing your journey with us today and the advice. Where can people find you online?
Oh, gosh. I would say probably the best source is LinkedIn. Just look me up, Gene Lee on LinkedIn. And if anybody wants, I'm also part of the ADP list, where I want to support anybody who has questions and, you know, help grow the design community. So you can go to adpdlist.org and look me up and sign up. And I always have office hours for anybody who wants to talk and chat. And yeah.
That's amazing. Well, thanks again, and have a wonderful rest of your week.
Cool. Thank you so much and the opportunity, Jane.